The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Roger Zackheim. He is a partner at Covington & Burling LLP here in Washington, D.C. And today we're going to be talking about all things defense policy, defense acquisition policy, whatever you want to talk about, Roger. So first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
And Roger, I know from your past, before you came to Covington, you served as Deputy Staff Director of the House Armed Services Committee. And in that role, like, you managed a lot of the legislation, obviously the NDAA, you know, all that process. So there's nobody better, I think, to have on the show to talk about what's going on with the NDAA right now, what are some of the interesting provisions, and also just the process. And so why don't we first just talk about the process where, you know, the House and the Senate both passed their version, and I guess we're in conference. So what happens in conference?
Sure. I'm an expert in the making of sausage. The sausage is that very refined process of legislation making in the Congress. And you're right, we're in the period right now.
People don't want to, like, see how that's made, right?
Yeah, generally don't want to lift the veil, you know, hope you've the food's settled already. Right. It's actually in the Armed Services Committee, and that's where I had previously worked. It's one of the functioning pieces of the U.S. Congress, which I'm sure listeners will raise their eyes and say there's a functioning part, but it actually does happen. For over 50 years, there's a consecutive, 50 consecutive years, there's a bill signed into law on the defense policy.
Right. Isn't that why everybody, you know, like from government-wide acquisition policy perspective, for example, that's why stuff gets tacked onto the NDAA, because it gets passed every year. Is that fair to say?
That's exactly right. The name of the game, the coin of the realm, if you have a legislative idea, is basically to find a vehicle to get you there. And as I mentioned, the defense authorization bill is a dependable vehicle for any policy, and there needs to be some sort of nexus with defense. But when you have an authorization bill that accounts for about 50% of your discretionary budget, you don't have to be too creative to find a nexus point. And you're right, Roger. We're going to have to figure out this Roger thing here.
But, that's right. It's Roger squared today.
There we go. I'll just be Zackheim. When it comes to things that are government-wide and policies, when it comes to acquisition or procurement, it's quite natural to ask the question, hey, is this something we want to do across the board? And we have a couple examples of those in this year's defense authorization bill. But first, the process. We are at this point, at the moment where both the House and the Senate have passed their versions of the defense authorization bill. They've authorized, you know, over $600 billion for the Department of Defense, and that covers everything from the training and the equipment to the major defense platforms to everything that you need in an office, from the computers to the printers to the papers, and to taking care of the bases overseas and the bases at home. So it's totally comprehensive. And there are major differences, as you might expect, between the House view of the world and the Senate view of the world. Most people think that perhaps the differences in the Capitol are between Republicans and Democrats, but somebody who's a veteran of these committees, you often find that the cultures of the Senate and the House almost provide more passionate differences that are harder to kind of bridge the gap than even partisan differences. And that's what's going on right now. When we talk about a conference, you're reconciling those two bills. They're in that period of where they're reconciling that. And I think the hope on the part of Chairman Mac Thornberry in the House and the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator John McCain, they're looking to try to get this done probably in the next month. And of course, the hope to get it done soon after the fiscal year is certainly a good one. In reality, rarely do they get the defense authorization bill done in time for the next fiscal year. It would have been done already, but they usually get it done before the end of the calendar year.
I think right around Christmas.
Yeah. It's always that Christmas gift for the Pentagon.
A gift that keeps on giving, right?
There we go. But, you know, it's ironic. You talk about a gift that keeps on giving. I remember one time we had Secretary Rumsfeld come to the House Armed Services Committee to speak to members. This is when he was Secretary of Defense during the Bush administration. And he was lamenting the annual gift that he gets from the Congress, telling him how he should spend his money, a very Rumsfeldian view of the world. It was his Pentagon, his money. And he recalled when he was Secretary of Defense the first time, because this was his second stint back in the 70s in the Ford administration, he recalled either then or when he was or reflecting when he was a congressman that the Defense Authorization Bill was only 14 pages long. I think I've written provisions of law that are 14 pages long. So that was certainly, I think, from his standpoint, a liability. On the other hand, though, I think if you ask a lot of people in the Department of Defense whether they like having an annual law, they probably say yes, because in some respects, it's a more efficient way to make change in the department than going through the regulatory process. So we could talk about that as well. But suffice it to say, I would expect a defense authorization bill this year. The staff is negotiating. The conferees, that is the members in the House and the Senate that have been designated to resolve the differences, are hard at work. And I fully expect it to get done.
Right. So Roger, what are some of the, the provisions you're following and tracking that are interesting to you and to your, your clients?
Well, things that are interesting to me, we hope are also interesting to clients, but there's a variety of issues.
Yeah, I get that.
They're tactical ones they're ones that are broader policy. I think the ones that are most interesting this week, as I look at the heartburn letter that Secretary Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, sent over to the Congress, he sees the train leaving the station on the conference report, and he wants to make sure that his views are known to the conferees, that they don't include anything in that conference report that he can't live with, or at least he's done his part to make them aware of what he opposes or what he's concerned about. There are a number of interesting ones. I think the one that starts out is the budget caps. So unpacking that for a quick moment, the Department of Defense, like the rest of the federal government, is subject to the Budget Control Act, which is a set of statutory caps on how much you can spend. And for the Department of Defense, that is less than the Secretary of Defense wants and less than the Congress wants. I say that the Congress wants to give DOD relief. That's a true statement. At the same time, the Congress has been able to figure out how to give them that relief.
Does it have to be offset?
And so, Roger, you got it. It seems to be this perennial annual discussion of, well, if we give defense more, do we have to give the non-defense more? What's the ratio? And it's that calculus that has been very difficult for the Congress to cut through. But people like John McCain and Mac Thornberry and Jack Reed and Adam Smith, they've all authorized in this bill funding that is way above the Budget Control Act. And for the Secretary of Defense, he loves that. Some might say he should be advocating for that more than he has been. But he also has to be mindful of the fact that if you authorize me to spend, in the case of the Senate, $640 billion, in the case of the House, $631 billion, but in the end, my appropriation is way south of that, how does that help me? And so Congress, outside of the Defense Authorization Bill, will be doing this dance as we approach the end of the calendar year, figuring out what we are going to spend for the Department of Defense. And that's where, again, to continuing resolution discussions
right,
as well.
And how does it impact the rest of the budget? Right?
Exactly.
Just a follow-up there. So there's a consensus, I guess, that the department needs more funding. Why is that? Is it coming out of the last 15 years, the war on terror, and trying to, everything's worn out, and we haven't invested in systems into the future. What is the thinking there? Is that all that?
Yes, okay. And yes. So, you're kind of hitting on something that I spent a lot of time thinking about and working on. Why is the Department of Defense in need of more funding? The reality is that since World War II, the Department of Defense, our military, and the U.S. government as a whole has decided that prosperity that we enjoy economically relies in major part due to the security, not only security within the United States, but global security and our ability to trade globally and back up from a security standpoint the framework and structures that allow the U.S. companies to be the great providers of goods to everyone in the world necessitated a stable security environment, and the U.S. has been the guarantor for that. The last time we had actually made capital investments across our military in every area to make sure that the world is stable, that the U.S. can respond to threats to that stability, was during the Reagan buildup. That's the name for it, during the Reagan administration.
So you're talking 30 years ago.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of joke, you know, they talk about President Trump wanting to have a military parade, and there are people who say, wow, that's not the way we do it. We're supposed to celebrate our military personnel and not our military equipment. And I take that point and probably agree with it. But if you would have a military parade going down Pennsylvania Avenue, I think people would say, wow, that looks like one of those parades of, you know, kind of classics from, you know, old vehicles, you know, right. You have in small towns. Look at that. Look at that classic.
Well, you could. I got a data touch point, a historical. So the parades that they had after Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
Right, in the Capitol, and it's probably all the same equipment,
yeah,
right?
That's exactly
so
right.
And that's 25 years ago?
Yeah, you got to go back to 1991 or so.
Yeah, yeah.
So it'd be instructive then as to why we need to kind of recapitalize. And that's not only in terms of the tanks and the planes, but also the force itself, the facilities. You take that, you look at the 90s where we basically took the view that the end of the Cold War, there'd be a peace dividend, so we stopped investing. And then even over the past 15 years, we added investment, but we added investments in a really narrow area to be able to, as we should have, to prevail in Iraq and Afghanistan, which you referenced. But the wholesale reinvestment and to make sure that we have a fighting force of the 21st century has not taken place.
Right.
And that is why President Trump called for a rebuild of the military.
Right, and right there, we'll have to stop right there. We're up on the break, Roger. My guest today is Roger Zackheim. He is a partner at Covington Burling LLP. We're talking about defense policy, the NDAA, all things defense today. And when we come back, we'll continue the discussion. Well, that was the budget. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the you know, interesting provisions in the NDAA itself, in the companion NDAAs. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Roger Zackheim. He's a partner at Covington & Burling. We're talking about the NDAAs and current defense policy in general. And Roger, when we took the break, he laid out the budget issues or the budget context with regard to the NDAA and the overall budget and how they are interrelated. But now let's talk about some of the interesting provisions in the two NDAs, or one and not in the other. Mm-hmm. Who knows? But I'm turning it over to you. What intrigued you?
Well, what I'm looking at is what they call the reform pieces of the Defense Authorization Bill. And this has been an effort on the part of John McCain, Mac Thornberry, everybody who's interested in defense policy, and it goes to Ash Carter, the previous Secretary of Defense, as well. How are we going to reform the Department of Defense to make sure that it's a defense department for the 21st century, that its procurement systems, it's what it's acquiring, the technologies it's using are actually leveraging everything the 21st century has to offer? And that you can divide that into organizational reform. There's some movement on that. And there's reform in terms of the processes and the types of things that we need to procure. Of course, the challenge here is, you know, one person's view of reform is another person's, kind of death knell for the Defense Department. And so there isn't widespread agreement across all these things. I mean, one that's out there that I think is a very interesting one, but example of how people aren't coming out on the same view on it is a Space Corps. So space is a new domain in warfare, or it's in the sense that we've been aware of it, but the technology has accelerates to the point that everybody agrees that the space architecture that our warfighters rely on to carry out operations is a contested domain. The question is, are we organized as a Department of Defense to really deal with all the questions, whether space is something we want to have offensive space weapons? Can we defend the platforms that are out there that we rely upon? Are we trained in getting the right personnel who focus adequately on this? Are we leveraging commercial space technology, which has kind of boomed?
Yeah.
Whether it's SpaceX or you know, Bezos's annual billion-dollar investment in his own space kind of hobby here. This is stuff with this great advantage.
Nice to have a $1 billion hobby, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you can just take it out of your stock and you're still worth billions after you spend it. That's a good life.
Yeah.
And so this has kind of taken form in a number of different ways, but the one I think that's getting the most attention is the Space Corps, where the House bill would say, listen, just like we only had Army, Marine Corps, and Navy, and we created an Air Force, are we at the period now where we need dedicated attention to space? And that's the approach the House has taken, and the rationale there has some merit, because in the absence of giving that dedicated attention, you're probably going to miss things. Secretary of Defense, I think, managing all the different types of reforms and trying to wrap his arms around a very difficult building to wrap your arms around, saying, I don't need another service or corps, which was understandable. And this is kind of, there's nothing new under the sun. We constantly have these debates about how we need to organize, and they're important debates, but that's one to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
What will be the outcome in the defense authorization bill with respect to Space Corps?
So, you know, correct me, but is the Space Corps sort of function that's envisioned, is that primarily the Air Force now, or?
Yeah, Air Force would be the service, kind of in the lead on that. And not surprisingly, not only is the Secretary of Defense opposed to the Space Corps, but the Department of the Air Force as well. And
sure,
the Air Force Secretary Heather Wilson doesn't support it either. And you know, the casualty of this debate would be that however we come out with the Space Corps without it, I'll probably put my money on not having it. What's most important is that there's actually a debate, and that we continue to ask the question: Are we postured?
People focus on the.
We have to.
We
absolutely have to, and it's not just about space wars. It's not just about whether China is truly developing, kind of operating concepts to take out their our satellites, which we rely upon, which I do believe,
yes.
And you know they're going to hold them at bay. But it's saying, are we postured and organized to train and equip a force that could protect those elements and that can prevail in a conflict in space.
Right.
So, you know, that's a big one. It definitely is we've kind of married up the engineers and the NASA folks and the best and the brightest with the policymaking and the sausage of Washington, which perhaps is dangerous. But, you know, there are a variety of other reforms.
One I wanted to ask you. It's the National Defense, National Technology Industrial Base provision. What is that? And what are we trying to accomplish there?
Yeah. So that's, of course, in the world of alphabet soup, that's the NTIB, right?
Yep.
And that's a very interesting one. The Senate has been highlighting this. This is the second year in a row it's highlighted it. This is originally a longstanding provision in Title 10 U.S. Code that stood for the following proposition. When the United States evaluates its industrial base, primarily the defense industrial base, as a matter of U.S. law and policy, it should not only look at what resides within the 50 states of the United States, but also look at what our ally Canada has.
Okay.
That is the stated policy. Title 10 U.S. Code there. What happened in last year's bill, it was incorporated in NDA, but started in the Senate with Senator McCain. The NTIB was expanded not only to include Canada, but the United Kingdom and Australia. So in the world of intelligence community, and we think about our closest allies, we talk about 5I, right? Mm-hmm. U.S., Canada, Australia, U.K., and New Zealand.
Yeah.
I guess they left New Zealand out because when it comes to industrial base, they're kind of not carrying their weight, or perhaps they are carrying their weight, but it's not enough weight to be with the others.
Yes.
And that's consistent. You look at Iraq and Afghanistan and the allies we're close with, sharing intelligence with, operating with. And you kind of want to have a commensurate type of sharing with the UK and Australia. So the defense bill last year modified Title 10 U.S. Code and said, welcome to the club. This year, the Senate is trying to kind of give more definition and meaning to the National Technology Industrial Base. It's already had some meaning because one of the things the Trump administration has looked at is kind of what's called a 232 investigation, which is a different national security-related investigation dealing with trade. And it stands for the proposition of, are our trade practices in any way impairing our national security. That's what the 232 investigation looks at. And they did done two that are notable on the 232 investigation, one looking at steel and one looking at aluminum. And mostly that's a result of China.
Yeah.
And China's trade practices. But there are other countries that are involved in the trade of aluminum and steel, Canada being the most notable. And one of the questions was, would Canada even be included in a 232 investigation because of the national technology industrial base? Because U.S. law says, you know, from a national security standpoint, it doesn't impair national security. We rely on them to be a source for us. Now we're looking at whether or not NTIP countries should benefit in other areas like industrial security, which is what the Senate looks like, perhaps one day, export controls. And, and I'm sure once we've expanded the club to those allies, others will want to participate
knock
as well.
On the door, right?
And so that's another interesting one that, again, you know, perhaps presents with the all-important win-win opportunity, because the more you get industrial-based kind of cooperation, investment in the U.S., that's something that the Trump administration certainly wants. The more that countries are investing in their own defense and are going to buy the U.S. Platforms, that's something U.S. companies want. And so it all stands for that proposition, potentially.
Yeah. Okay. Now let's turn to some of the things you're following that are a bit more, let's say, procurement focused. In the NDA, there's the bid protest provision.
Yeah. So there's a few of them. There's a bid protest provision. There's also reform dealing with DCAA. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, the online marketplace, another one. But the bid protest one is interesting. Certainly, being a lawyer who works in government contracts and participates on bid protests, caught our attention. Again, this is something that's been a longstanding a policy approach by the Senate. Last year, they sought to, quote-unquote, reform the bid protest. And it comes from a view that the number of bid protests have increased, and it's kind of gumming up the acquisition system. And so that's a statement of the problem, and they've thought about ways to, quote-unquote, reform it, solve that problem.
Right.
My own view is that, listen, there's certainly environmental things going on here which are driving that behavior. One, as the defense budget has decreased, as we've spent less in the form of procurements or less capture opportunities for business.
Yes.
So
the stakes are higher, right?
Exactly. The stakes are higher. If you are at risk of losing a contract, you really need to fight tooth and nail for it. That explains behavior in part. There's a theory out there that because you have a lot of companies that either are owned by private equity or they're publicly traded, there's almost a fiduciary duty to protest because are you really returning value to the to shareholder by not taking advantage of the process laid out by Congress? And something about, you know, any bid protest, and GAO, of course, adjudicates, cannot go forward unless you have a colorable argument that somehow you've demonstrated that in one form or another, the view of one party is that the Department of Defense, and not in this case Department of Defense, but it's not something that limited, did not comply with acquisition law, wasn't applied correctly, and that's what you're protesting. It's really it's a legal dispute over the application of the acquisition law. The question is whether the process has been abused, and I think there's certainly cases where contractors have abused it or certainly exploited the system. The question is, and I think the question the Senate has to answer, is that how do you remedy it, and is bad case or bad facts the place to make law?
Right.
And that's really a question about reform writ large.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're up on our next break, Roger. My guest today is Roger Zackheim. He is a partner at Covington & Burling. And we're talking about NDA, defense policy as well. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion of the reform provisions of the NDA in the acquisition field. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Roger Zackheim. He is a partner at Covington & Burling. Spent many years on the Hill, from your youth, right, Roger?
You're making me feel my gray hair right now.
Hey, no, you don't have no gray hair. I'm the guy with the gray hair.
My 8-year-old picks them out every morning for me.
There you go. Well, I have too many. So I'd be bald if they were. But anyway, let's continue our discussion of the NDAA, and particularly some of the other acquisition reform or just reform provisions that that you're focusing on. And then maybe perhaps as we go through the segment, we can talk about some of the reform language that's already passed in previous NDAs and how the department is dealing with that. And I'm thinking in particular the split of AT&L.
But yeah,
let's start
yeah.
with what's in there currently.
Yeah. So, well, the reform, I think, really has taken kind of shape in two areas. One is the organizational reform. So I guess we'll get to that next, kind of how the department's organized. And then, of course, the way the department does business has been the other yeah. area of reform. In the latter, right, how the department does business, there's this recognition, which really I think Ash Carter, the previous Secretary of Defense, gets a lot of credit for, is saying, listen, technology is changing so fast, impacting our lives dramatically. Handheld devices do everything. How is that impacting the warfighter? Are we leveraging those technologies? And that took the form of Secretary Carter building out a framework for how we integrate commercial technologies that really need to be leveraged by the military and the Department of Defense. It's called DIUX, and he opened yep. one in Silicon Valley. He had another one in Boston, then in Austin. Like any good idea, immediately becomes a franchise, and everybody's imitating it. It's actually going to continue under Secretary Mattis. My favorite kind of riff on how DIUX has evolved or perhaps devolved is that this concept is great. We need to take advantage of artificial intelligence developments in the commercial world, robotics, right, big data, all of these things that we hear about, and we see these companies that haven't made a profit yet, but their market cap is, billions and billions and billions of dollars. Where is DOD involved in all that? But DIUX recognized after about, a couple of years, that the one office it was missing to be successful was not Silicon Valley. It was not Boston. It was not Austin. It needed an office in the Pentagon. That was the key, because it realized if its goal, if its mandate.
It's kind of a profound realization. That's
yeah. Right. Sometimes the simplest things are yeah. profound. And perhaps a sad commentary on what it takes to get work done in the military and Department of Defense. Part of what we had to do was go out and sell and somehow try to incentivize the startups and other innovators to do stuff with the Department of Defense and military, which for the most part, the world of Silicon Valley in particular wouldn't be interested in, because it's burdensome, huge barrier to entry, a lot of red tape. And oh, by the way, if you cross all those barriers, the margins I get there are not nearly the margins I need to satisfy my angel investors, my VCs, and everybody else. But even if you were able to get a couple interested, which they have done, mostly because it's a great validator to the commercial world if the military is interested in it.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and there are other reasons, but that's one you hear a lot. Then it was, well, how do you actually get the military to use it? And I think it's there that DIUX found, oh goodness, it's really burdensome. And if we're going to help these guys and make them successful working with the military, we got to work the building. And that's been kind of one of the developments, which is somewhat ironic. But there are other reforms that the Congress is saying, hey, there are practices in the commercial world we need you to focus on. Two that jump out. Auditing
yes.
has been, an area of focus by the Congress. The Congress mandated that the DOD shockingly needed to have a comprehensive audit by 2017. Not a clean audit, but just be able to audit,
yes.
right?
Yes.
They're a little behind on that. But some of the auditing agencies within the Department of Defense, and the Congress have been pretty critical of DCAA,
mm-hmm.
Defense Contracting Auditing Agency, that they have a huge backlog. It takes too long, and it actually costs a lot of money and waste
sure
money.
Sure does, yes. I've heard that complaint. So to remedy that, is that third part?
Yeah, so they're saying, okay, well, what kind of audits could we bring third parties in? If it works for the commercial world, can it work for DOD? They follow their general, kind of accounting procedures. That ought to be enough mm-hmm. for the Department of Defense, certainly for the kind of operations and maintenance business. Maybe the auditing that goes for other things, perhaps not. And that's run into resistance, of course. But the idea, the concept.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, it's not a good idea if no one's resisting. The worst thing is there's apathy, right?
So that's validation.
There we go, right? Yeah. If you're doing something nobody cares, then you're really not doing something.
Right.
But I think what's going to happen here is there's a backlog. How are you going to remedy the backlog? It's probably sound viewed. Let's give the third parties, commercial auditors, an opportunity that have expertise in the federal domain, which there are.
Yes.
And other agencies do this already.
Right. Yeah, it should be a standard business practice. And those backlog in and of itself costs money.
Right? Absolutely.
It costs money.
And I think for contractors, you hear these stories, and I've never validated it, but if you have one of the big auditing houses, it's not like they live in your facility for months or years on end. For the DCA, the reputation is it seems to be a permanent presence. So to let somebody else do it, is certainly attractive, I think, to the industry folks.
Right. Well, because a private business has the pressure of being efficient.
That's,
how about that?
There we go.
I said that.
Yeah.
Right.
There
okay.
we go. Well, I'm nodding violently.
Okay. So another thing I wanted.
Go ahead, please.
Any other? Any quick thought? I know there's the marketplace provision.
The marketplace provision is interesting. It's going to be, debated, and it was in the House bill. I was kind of highlighting some of the Senate reforms and kind of give credit to my old committee on the House Armed Services Committee. They're really leading in reform this year with the DCA provision and online marketplace. But that simply stands for the proposition that you and I, Roger, will buy whatever is on our honey-do list. First thing we'll do rather than going out to the store is we'll pull out our app and purchase it, right, from some online distributor. And the question is, when DoD goes out and buys, can they have an online marketplace too? Businesses are leveraging that. You pretty much can do it in a way that gives you assurances on cost, on competition, that you're getting the best price. There might be a more efficient way for DoD to do business through an online marketplace.
Right. So yeah, it's interesting to see how that provision.
Like everything else, it's once you give it to the Department of Defense and take into account all the regs, or even probably government wide. It gets pretty thorny, and it's a difficult thicket to work through.
You know what? We're already up on the break, but when we come back for the last segment, one thing I want to ask you first about the split of AT&L and how that's going and what's it mean for the department. That was in last year's NDA. It's got to be done by February
2018. Yep.
Yeah. So that's pretty soon, actually, when you stop and think about it. And then I'm going to ask you about some of your other activities out there. I understand you're a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and you're working on this thing called the Reagan National Defense Forum. My guest today is Roger Zachheim. He is a partner at Covington & Burling, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Roger Zachheim. He is a partner at Covington & Burling, and we're talking about the NDA and defense policy in general and the Department of Defense. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you about before you got off the show, Roger, is about the reorg of AT&L, the splitting of that organization. How is that into two different entities? One sort of focusing, as I understand it, on promoting research, development, and that kind of thing. Another one with more the nuts and bolts sort of acquisition and all the other good stuff. So how is it going?
Well, the Department of Defense is trying to implement it. This is for sure the element of congressional reform of DoD that's gotten the most attention and is probably the most significant. AT&L, Acquisition Technology Logistics, is generally referred to as the Pentagon's chief weapons buyer, and it's an undersecretary.
Yes.
So in the world of DoD bureaucracy, you have the Secretary of Defense, you have a Deputy Secretary of Defense, and you have five undersecretaries. AT&L is one of the most prominent undersecretaries. The concern as part of that was driving this reform was that DoD was not adequately taking risk in the weapon systems it was buying. It was, for a number of reasons, Congress is in part responsible for this, was playing it too safe and was not taking too long to procure systems. And I think most importantly, was not fielding technologies that would ensure that we were responding to what our adversaries and enemies were doing. Think China, think Russia. And the view was that we were de-emphasizing research engineering, kind of testing, and allowing DoD to fail in a safe way when it comes to developing technologies. So the outcome, Congress changed the organizational chart and added a sixth undersecretary. You'll have the undersecretary for acquisition and sustainment, and you'll have an undersecretary of defense for R&E, research engineering. As in the R&E function, I think particularly Senator McCain hoped would be the antidote to this real problem of not kind of failing and testing and taking risk to ensure that we would be able to fight the fight of the future. And the idea is that you do enough in the R&E side, is kind of controlled testing, then it could be integrated appropriately to the ANS side, or procuring things when they're ready. We're not going to suffer from, here's a good acquisition policy word, concurrency, right? Where one piece of the system is ready, but the other piece is not. And that it would also allow the acquisition side to buy things within, you know, a cycle that may not be commercial, you know, not going to get done in 2 years, but certainly not going to be generational. That's yes. The idea you buy something and you you actually get it in 20 years. That's what the concept was. The question is this something that needed to be solved by adding a layer of bureaucracy? Do you need a sixth undersecretary? Is that the way you address the problem? And I think that's where the skepticism resides.
Right. And it's symbolic. At the beginning of the show, in the first segment, you talked about Congress's role in the fact that, you know, the welcoming at NDAA, the department each year, because it allows change to take place, I guess. This sort of reflects that here's change being made. It may or may not be the right change. I don't know.
It's a change agent.
Yeah, it's a change agent. And I guess it sort of reflects the concern that, or the observation that the department can't change itself as rapidly.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think that's true.
I'm struggling, but it's struck me.
I think that formulation works. I think the department would, and the people who work in the Department of Defense, look to the Congress at times to make changes.
Right.
So we would get, when I was in the Armed Services Committee, you get your official request that came with a OMB, Office of Management and Budget, kind of validation saying, good, you can ask Congress for this. But there'd be a lot of other things that came through saying, you guys really need to look at this.
Right.
And which we did. And there's a lot of technologies and things that the Congress has pushed the Department of Defense to employ that have become essential, whether it's, you know, kind of unmanned systems, which is pushed, or MRAPs, that these vehicles that were able to absorb blasts from IEDs in Iraq and Afghanistan, which saved lives.
Yeah.
That came from Congress's priorities.
Right. Okay, so you're a fellow, all right, at the American
visiting fellow at
visiting
the American Enterprise Institute.
Make sure I get that terminology correct.
Visiting can't give
fellow,
me a promotion here.
Right, at the American Enterprise Institute. So what are you doing over there?
So at AEI, there's a great team of people at the Maryland Ware Center for Security Studies, where we focus on national security policy and defense studies. And that gives me an opportunity to work with the fellows there, people like Tom Donnelly, Gary Schmidt, and Mackenzie Eaglin, on national defense strategy, budgets, force posture, all sorts of defense wonkiness that I really like to geek out on, that you don't have an opportunity to work on day-to-day in a legal practice. And we put out studies that really try to lay out the view for what a national defense strategy ought to look like, how we need to posture ourselves to make sure we can prevail in the 21st century.
Sounds fascinating. I'm telling you, it sounds really interesting. I'm envious.
It's fun.
Yeah. Okay. And another thing you're working hard on, and I guess the event is coming up shortly or in December, it's the Reagan National Defense Forum. So what is that?
The Reagan National Defense Forum, and I'll speak proudly here, it's kind of one of my babies. I have four children, a fifth on the way, but I guess the forum is my sixth. Okay. This is something we started 5 years ago, and the purpose of it is to bring together all of the stakeholders of the national defense community for a day and a half at the Reagan Library, Presidential Library out in Simi Valley, California, to focus on one thing, U.S. national defense. Asking questions are like the ones we've discussed today, from not only do we have the right platforms, but are we taking care of the people? Are the military benefits right? Are we working with our allies in the way we should? What does defense reform have to look like? And that event is something that is co-chaired by Chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Buck McKeon, a former chairman, really deserves credit for starting it. And John Hybush, the executive director of the library, embraced it. And it's almost this grand offsite. And we have the Secretary of Defense comes every year, service chiefs. We give out something called the Peace Through Strength Award, which, of course, refers to what Ronald Reagan and his legacy was, which was saying, hey, the best way we can preserve peace and the way we prevailed over in the Cold War was making sure we were strong, investing in our military, taking care of our military. And I think the forum is a convening forum to talk about those ideas. We've had some great events in the past, memorable moments, and it gets over 600 people. Last year, we had over 20 members of Congress, service chiefs, all the stakeholders, CEOs, and then also, most importantly, we get people who are going to be the next generation leaders in national defense and have them go toe-to-toe and face-to-face with our current leadership.
Right, and that's December 1st and 2nd?
December 1 and 2.
Right. And so how did this come about? What was the genesis of this?
Thanks for asking that. It started when, really around the time that Buck McKeon, who was a former chairman of the Armed Services Committee, he was a ranking member at the time, he's from California. We went out and gave a speech. I should say he went out and gave a speech. I joined him laying out his priorities because he was going to become the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. And at that time, the Reagan Library had just been redistricted in his district. And people always go out to the Reagan Library. They have presidential debates there.
Sure, yeah.
It's a great venue to give a talk, particularly if you're a congressman from California. And we gave a speech out there, and it was just clear that the library would have loved to convene and talk about national defense. And we are at a moment where defense is really challenged. Sequestration has just hit. The department was looking at over $1 trillion cut to its budget. And the community of all the stakeholders, Congress, the Pentagon, industry, thought leadership, the press, they weren't really getting together and talking about it. And you have lots of conferences where people hobnob between, you know, our allies and ministers of defense. And we had nothing that focused exclusively on U.S. national defense at a high level, not a particular platform or system, but talking about the health of the overall defense of this country. And the library got behind it. And 5 years later, it's become what we modestly call the Davos for Defense.
Oh, very good. Yeah. I like that.
I don't get credit for it, but I use it all the time for coming up with that.
Right. Well, you know what? Roger, you have a standing invitation to come back on the show. And I'm going to have you back in the new year to talk about what happened in the final NDAA and also get a report out on the conference.
That'd be great.
We got to figure out
how that sausage tastes, right?
That's right. Absolutely. I want to thank my guest today, Roger Zachheim. He is a partner at Covington & Burling, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.